Judiciary Committee to order Thursday, March 24th, 2011. We're going to go out of sequence. We're going to open a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 3323. Representative Matthews.
And co-chairs, members of the committee, House Bill 3323 pertains to the definition of visual depiction in crimes pertaining to child pornography. Modifies the definition of, quote, knowingly possess or control by removing photographs, films, videotapes, pictures, or computers and replacing those with the term visual recording. This is then subsequently defined to include those things, but also digital pictures, regardless of any manner in which the recording is stored. The practical import of this is that if an individual accesses images on a computer but does not download them, that will qualify under the definition of possess.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Greg Matthews, State Representative for House District 50, the great city of Gresham. Proud to be here testifying in favor of House Bill 3323. Some of you may recall, in fact, probably all of us can recall, that there was a recent ruling in the Supreme Court, and it was broadcasted throughout the state in the Oregonian, on a ruling about child pornography and whether or not having child pornography was actually possessing child pornography and whether or not somebody could be charged as a crime. And the ruling was basically, at that point, no. I'm sure there's others in the room that will get into the technical details of that decision. But for me, honestly, this came down to a protection of children and also an understanding of what it is that we're trying to accomplish and keeping up with modern-day technology. You'll see that in the bill, visual recording includes, not limited to, photographs, films, videotapes, and computer and other digital pictures, regardless of the manner in which the recording is stored. I'm going to be honest, I've got three little girls, 10, 7, and 5. Every time I take them to a carnival, anytime I take them anywhere, I worry about their safety. I also worry about recording devices just about everywhere they go. There's a lot of sick people in this world. And those folks need to be held accountable. And if we can find areas in the law that they're using as loopholes, we need to shut those and make sure we're holding those folks accountable. So my excitement in supporting this issue is more about recognizing that there's some folks that need a great deal of help, that are preying on a lot of our children, and that we do something about it at our level to hold them accountable. My wife and I own a daycare with 86 kids a day. It's right near a bus stop on Division Street in Gresham. Not saying everybody at the bus stop is doing something inappropriate, but it does come to mind. If we report people that are suspicious in nature and they're conducting themselves in an egregious fashion, I'm just a member that wants to see them held accountable. And when I read the ruling, I felt like this has to be done. And Department of Justice, I think, probably had that reaction an hour before I did, if not days before I did. So they're all over this. I'm happy to report. I know that the good representative, co-chair Barker, is over this as well, and I sure hope that you'll find the ability to work this bill and move this bill to the floor.
Committee, do you have any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that.
John Kroger. John, did you bring anybody with you or your staff or anything?
I've got staff present in case there are questions I can't answer, but okay. I'm hoping my testimony will be adequate.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'm John Kroger. I'm the Attorney General of Oregon, and I'd like to thank the chair and the committee for their leadership in taking up this issue. Oregon's child pornography statute has never been updated for the information, modern information age, and that's had a significant negative impact. As Representative Matthews testified, we had a decision from the Oregon Supreme Court earlier this year that held that our statute, which criminalizes possession of child pornography, did not apply to the viewing or watching of child pornography on a computer unless someone purchased, downloaded, or printed the material. Simply viewing it in the court's view was not possession and thus is not criminalized on the in the statute. And that makes Oregon the only state that I'm aware of that does not criminalize the viewing of child pornography on the internet. H. Bill 3323 is designed to fix that problem using language borrowed from the federal statute, which of course applies in Oregon. It criminalizes knowingly accessing or viewing child pornography on a computer. We've provided a number of safeguards to make sure that someone who is not intentionally accessing this material is not prosecuted. There are certainly concerns people have about, you know, what happens if someone, a hacker, downloads something on my computer without my knowledge. What happens if someone sends me spam that contains a child pornographic image? How do I make sure that those people are not prosecuted? The protections we've put in, first, the bill only criminalizes knowingly accessing the material, so that if something happened that you were not aware of or that was inadvertent, it would not be a criminal offense. Second, the accessing has got to be with the intent to view the material. The government will have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that you're, when this stuff winds up on your computer, you're intending to watch it. And finally, there's the requirement, which has always been in the statute, that when you access or view the material, it has to be for the purpose of arousing or satisfying sexual desires. And so someone who, for instance, wound up with child pornographic materials, I think this happens almost never, but it could happen, inadvertently a hacker or someone emails spam to them that contains such an image. If they were accessed it to see what it was or to access it to clear it off their computer somehow, that would not be a violation of the statute. So we've taken safeguards to make sure that the accidental, unintentional, inadvertent appearance of child pornography on some computer won't be a crime, while still making sure that we've got the tools to go after people who are intentionally watching this material on their computers. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair, thank you. I'd like to thank Representative Matthews. Being the father of a young daughter, I'm very concerned about this as well, and I appreciate your testifying. Sorry I didn't say when you're up here. And to Mr. Attorney General, I'm glad you're here on this. Some departments spend a lot of money pursuing things that don't help the state. I'm glad to see the Department of Justice here testifying on behalf of a bill that's going to help our state. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the day that really came down, I was in contact with judiciary staff, and I want to compliment additionally the Department of Justice for immediately getting on that and correcting that gaping loophole, which we can't blame the courts for, because, as you said, technology got ahead of the law on this. And so thank you very much for your hard work getting that ready to go.
Anything further? Thank you, John.
Thank you, sir.
We have Fred Yates, John Powell, and Kevin Campbell.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Haraldson. I am the district attorney for Benton County, state of Oregon. I am here to offer some perspective through my testimony with regards to House Bill 3323. And I would like to begin by underscoring one of the points that Attorney General John Kroger made with regards to the safeguards that are built into this bill. As you recall in his testimony, Attorney General Kroger indicated that there is a criminal mental state in this proposal, which is to act knowingly, but also includes a provision with intent. Those are an act that is alleged intentionally are the highest levels of mental culpability or mental state that can be attributed to a person when we're designing a crime or elements of a crime. I want to underscore that because what the bill establishes by selecting those mental states of safeguards is specifically that it's not utilizing the remaining lesser mental states, which could include strict liability offenses, criminal negligence, or recklessness. And to illustrate that a little bit further, in the event that there are any existing concerns that this could somehow create a problem for somebody who accidentally stumbles across some of this material, that when we talk about criminal negligence, we're talking about somebody who should be aware of a substantial and unjustifiable risk, and that they should have been, they acted despite the fact that they should have been aware of that. With recklessness, we're talking about somebody who is aware of a substantial and unjustifiable risk. And being aware of that, they still engage in the conduct, and that conduct constitutes a gross deviation from the standard of care that a reasonable person would observe under those circumstances. Those are important safeguards to be aware of, to know that if somebody committed this type of act under that mental state, it would not satisfy the elements of this offense. It actually has to be something that somebody is fully aware of what they're doing. They're wanting to do it. And so those are really important standards to keep in mind with regards to what our job is as prosecutors in proving these crimes. Now, from a perspective of working, you know, in the battle lines, if you will, in terms of the cases that we see. We see cases where there are thousands of pieces of evidence of this nature that begin to present evidence, or do present evidence of what the person's intent is at that time. The other fascinating piece here is that this proposal really underscores the reality that we live in with respect to the fact that technology is moving so fast that we're left to react as we discover manners in which it can be exploited to conceal criminal conduct. The possession, the management of pornographic materials or child pornographic materials is clandestine by nature. And as a result of being clandestine by nature, we do know that there are individuals that are constantly looking for a place to be able to keep this stuff in a way that they're not going to get in trouble. And what's great about this proposal is that once this bill becomes law, if it does so, it will send out a message that this exception is no longer a safe place to keep this stuff. It closes that door. And I believe that by the existence of this, it will eliminate a safe place in some people's minds for keeping this type of material. I welcome any questions.
We'll go ahead to the panel.
Chair Krieger and Barker and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. We're here, obviously, to add our support to the comments that the Attorney General's made, and Mr. Haroldson as well. We have a strong interest in this in terms of the bill itself, and we're experiencing a similar challenge in law enforcement, as you know, as these crimes become crimes that our police departments are now investigating more aggressively. In addition to cities like Portland that have a lot of resources, we have cities like Central Point and Newburgh-Dundee that are focusing on internet crimes against children. It's a growing and scary emerging area of crime. And so as the law begins to keep up with these crimes, our police agencies are as well. And we're very supportive of the effort here and wanted to add our voice of support with that, chairs and members of the committee. I'll turn it over.
Chair Krieger and Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Fred Yates. I'm from Linn County. I am in total and complete support of the intent of this bill and thank everybody that's worked on it and put their time against it. And I hope that the August committee recognizes the need to future protect our children from this form of abuse that potentially damages and clouds their future. And I feel somewhat daunted sitting here in a room full of lawyers and wordsmiths that I would challenge a pair of their words. But I'm going to do it. They have a very narrowly defined phrase, visual recording. And I've been in the industry for a long time. And if you read my comments, which I'm not going to read to you, you'll discover that it's slight changes in the law makes it so broad that it anticipates the future. And we want to anticipate the future so we can stop this forever. I just ask you to review that page. Thank you. And I'll take any questions later.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is John C. Powell on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. And to what will probably come as a great displeasure to many of you, my testimony is going to be very brief. The sheriffs support this bill and thank everybody who has worked on it. Thank you.
Any members questions? Must have stunned them or something.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's all we have. All right, we'll close the public hearing on at a possible work session on House Bill 3323 and open a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2139.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, House Bill 2139 makes modifications to the existing application process for driver's licenses, driver's permits, identification cards, and the temporary versions of those items in two ways. First of all, under existing law, application requires proof of both a legal presence in the United States and documents corroborating a Social Security number. That second requirement under this bill would be you provide your Social Security number, you do not need to provide the corroborating documentation. Secondly, under existing law, a temporary identification card or permit is issuable by law when an applicant is unable to produce the documentation required for a permanent version. A temporary permit under existing law is valid for a period of 90 days and may be extended once for 60 days upon a showing of cause. House Bill 3153 modifies this provision to allow the permit to be extended two times upon a showing of cause, each for a 90-day period, and allows the department to further extend the term of the temporary permit for an applicant who needs additional time to obtain the documentation required.
Thank you. How about Amy Joy, Andrea Meyer, and Francisco Lopez?
Good afternoon, co-chairs Krieger and Barker and members of the committee. My name is Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation representing the DMV today. Being passed out to you is some written testimony, and the staff did an excellent job of summarizing what the bill will do. But by way of background, in 2008, this body passed Senate Bill 1080, which instituted requirements that a person applying for a new or renewal driver license at the DMV has to show proof of legal presence in this country. And in addition, when doing that application, must show on an official document their Social Security number, whether a Social Security card or a tax document, something of that nature. Current law, what we found in implementing this is that some limited number of folks have a difficult time coming up with the kinds of documents they need to prove they are who they say they are and they're legally in this country within basically immediately when their license is coming up for renewal. The law provided for a 90-day extension or temporary permit and a 60-day extension beyond that for a total of 150 days. The reality is that for some folks, this simply is not enough time. A couple of examples of that would be to get your birth certificate out of the state of California at this time can take up to 8 or 9 months, which goes well beyond your 150 days. Other examples include the more rare situations, folks who perhaps were born overseas on a military base to parents who are citizens of this country. Getting copies of the naturalization documents proving their legal presence in this country can take 8, 9, 10, 12 months to get from the federal government. So one thing that House Bill 2139 would do would be allow the DMV to grant further extensions to folks who have shown that they are making a concerted effort to obtain those documents so that they can continue to drive legally while they attempt to get a permanent license, either new or a renewal. The second thing the bill does is that currently folks have to show their Social Security number. But then what happens is the DMV clerk sort of turns to the computer, types that Social Security number into a computer system, federal database, which immediately kicks back that who that person is who's connected to that Social Security number. So with the documents that we already have showing proof of legal presence and proof of identity, showing a document is quite frankly a redundancy. And it causes customer service problems when folks have everything else they need but don't have their Social Security number with them on a card. We have to send them away and tell them to come back later when they have their Social Security number, when they can see that the DMV clerk has just verified their Social Security number via computer. So the bill does those two things, grants DMV longer time to grant these temporary permits to our customers, and secondly, does away with that requirement for the Social Security number to show up on an official document. This is a customer service bill, and we ask for your support.
Co-chairs Barker and Krieger, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon. I'm here today in support of House Bill 2139, specifically the provision regarding the Social Security card. I'm pleased 3 years after I testified before this legislature in what was, as you may recall, a very quick session in February 2008 on this very specific issue in Senate Bill 1080. Prior to that time, no one had to provide a document that contained their Social Security number. DMV was required to verify it. We urged the legislature in that session to not add this additional burden because, as we've seen what happens, many people don't have a Social Security card. I keep my little paper one buried in my desk, never to be carried with me. And it almost became, I think, a bit of just a hurdle because you could go print out a tax return, and if you just created one and entered your Social Security number, you therefore had a document containing that number. To be clear, and just for the record, to for consistency, the ACLU has and will continue to oppose the restrictions on who can obtain a driver's license in the state of Oregon. That is not the issue before you today, but it was the issue when Senate Bill 1080 arose. But I am pleased to see this change, which if anyone reviews my three-minute testimony in my written paper at that time, I urged happen. Thank you.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and committee members. My name is Francisco Lopez, and I'm the executive director of CAUSA, Oregon's Latino Immigrant Rights Coalition, and one of the largest Latino advocacy organizations in the Pacific Northwest. HB 2139 is an important piece of legislation because it acknowledges the hardship that the 2008 driver's license restrictions caused to thousands of Oregonians. Since passage of SB 1080 in 2008, victims of rural disaster, natural disasters, domestic violence survivors, the elderly, homeless people, and immigrants have found it very difficult or impossible to find the documents necessary to obtain an Oregon driver's license. We believe driver's license access is important for public safety and economic recovery in Oregon. All Oregonians are safer when drivers are tested, licensed, and insured. CAUSA strongly supports HB 2139 because it takes some steps to address difficulties people have had in getting licensed and insured. But even with passage of HB 2139, thousands of Oregon residents will still not be able to get an Oregon driver's license. We urge you to consider additional remedies to protect Oregonians' public safety, such as the proposed Senate Bill 845, which will restore driver's license access to all Oregonians, regardless of ability to prove legal status. Thank you very much.
Committee members, have any questions? Thank you. Close the public hearing, possible work session on House Bill 2139, and open a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 3131.
And co-chairs, members of the committee.
Excuse me, this is a technicality, but aren't we just opening a public hearing?
No.
And co-chairs, Representative Nolan, for the purpose of adopting amendments, I believe we've switched all public hearings over to hearings and possible work sessions.
But they're different entities.
But it gives us
you can open a public hearing and then open a public work, then open a work session. If you want to
understood. Okay. I thought she was asking.
Judiciary will do it the way the chairs open. Continue.
All right. House Bill 3131, which comes to us from Representative Olson, creates the new crime of unlawful delivery of salvia divinorum. This would be punishable as a Class A misdemeanor with a maximum term of 1 year imprisonment, a $6,250 fine, or both.
Yeah. Okay, have Randy Walker come up, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, and committee members, my name is Andy Olson. I am a state representative out of the Albany area. This bill, I don't know how many of you have heard much about salvia, but it is a psychoactive plant which can induce dissociative effects and is a potent producer of visions and other hallucinatory experiences. It is a plant that grows to over 3 feet high, has hollow square stems, large leaves, and occasional white flowers with a violet calyx or a stem base of the flower. Now, I'd be truthful with you, a year ago I had no idea what salvia was, but I have a drug recognition expert in the back room from Albany Police Department that will be testifying in another case, Robert Hayes from Albany Police Department, but he is quite familiar with this, and hopefully he'll come up and maybe just give you a few thoughts on what they're running into as well out there on the road. But I really want to impress upon you what's going on right now with this substance. It will floor you. And there's somehow we've got to do something for some gaining some control with what this is. The salvia produces a short-term 5 to 10-minute hallucinogenic state for the user. Now, we have two videos that we'd like to share with you. These we pulled up off the YouTube. And if you can go to the YouTube and you can just do a search on salvia and you'll get thousands of videos right now on YouTube with the youth who have experience and are trying this. But I really want you to see what's happening. Now, the first one has got a little bit of foul language in it. So be prepared. And understand this is what you deal with in the first place when you're going to be involved with this type of thing. So be prepared for some foul language. Okay.
Yeah, this is Anthony, first hit of 10X.
This is salvia, it's a legal drug in Canada now. I've just been 5X and I feel like I'm here. I didn't hallucinate about what it is, you're both like listening for about 5 minutes. And
look at that pro. Thank you. good? Yeah. What do you feel?
Heavy.
You can see how quickly that hit him. Now this next one you're going to see. Now this is kind of a college environment. This is a little disturbing. This kid has just inhaled a couple shots of it. They're having to help him sit down at this point to just kind of start recovering. Okay. I just want to continue on what you have in my letter to you. This substance is being abused at an alarming rate, specifically among youth and young adults. One can spend a few minutes on the YouTube just simply to see what just happened there. There is no control for accessibility. Simple research indicates the ease of obtaining salvia is but a mouse click away. You should have an attachment with you that gives you just a variety of different types, strengths, and how easy it is for you to just quick and get it through the internet for yourself. Except for the states that have either made the substance illegal to possess or the states who are proposing legislation to outlaw the substance, this substance is truly a tombstone without wider. Currently, there are 21 states that have banned the substance. Salvia is not regulated under the Controlled Substance Act. Individual states have moved forward on their own. The Oregon legislature has seen salvia divinorum before, which I didn't realize until I started doing the homework on it. But you had two bills back in 2003 that the legislature looked at, and they didn't go anywhere. And those two bills actually made it a Class B felony, punishable for 10 years, and also a fine of up to $200,000. And then in 2007, there was a bill that was introduced, again, didn't go anywhere, and was not given a hearing. It was 2494. But that was introduced and again made it a substance with a Class A misdemeanor, Schedule 1 controlled substance. The thing that's really bothersome about this is that we do have 21 states right now that have already banned this. Australia and Italy themselves have the strictest imposed regulations in the world. They have identified it as what they call Schedule 9. That would be equivalent to our Schedule 1 substance here in the United States. So with that, I do think there's an amendment that should be made with this, and I can share that with you toward the end of this, but I'll stop right here.
Okay. Wait, we'll have a question maybe when we're done.
Co-Chair Krieger, Co-Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Randy Wampler. I'm the Director of the Forensic Services Division for the Oregon State Police, and I'm just here to address a technical issue as it relates to the crime lab testing for salvia divinorum. Salvia divinorum is one of approximately 1,000 species that are covered under the genus Salvia. That genus includes the sage plants and such. As such, It's not possible for us to actually identify the plant Salvia divinorum. However, Salvia divinorum does contain the chemical compound salvinorin A, which is the active ingredient in the plant that causes the mind-altering effects. That is a chemical compound we can identify, and because of that, we can only limit our reporting in our analytical reports to the chemical compound of salvinorin A. So, and that's all I add.
Do we have any history that, you know, that this has ever been used or has any medical benefit? I don't want this thing to turn into what marijuana did.
Kutcher Krieger, I don't have that information. I think you'd probably have to contact either our health department or pharmacologists.
And Chair Krieger, I think actually if it might give you a shed a little bit more light on this too, with having the officer from Albany Police Department, Robert Hayes, you know, come up to his perspective too.
Let me start with
So I guess the question would be for either one of you. Do you know the any long-term effects of this?
Chair Krieger, Representative Tomei, the research that's out there right now, it's really unknown because this has come on so fast. And so I don't know what it has for impact, you know, for the mental capacity. I don't have any knowledge of what's happening physically with it. But I mean, you can see how quickly it hits you, and I just have some real concern with it right now. If you had somebody even get behind a steering wheel, and you're driving down the road doing this.
Follow up. Thank you. So how is it administered? Did I see him smoking it like sort of like in a bong, or like marijuana or something?
Yeah. Again, Chair Krieger and Representative Tomei. General use of it is through using a bong, a water type pipe, and then inhaling it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Schaffer.
Nope, I'm good. Thanks.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quickly, I looked it up. I used dog pile, so I dog piled Salvia divinorum medical benefits.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, sorry. I did look this up just now online, health benefits of Salvia divinorum, and there is a discussion group, dosenation.com. So it sounds real legitimate. Actually, as an aside article, Dr. Hunter S. Thompson interviews Keith Richards. Anyway, this article says that various research studies indicate that Salvia divinorum has great healing potential. Ongoing laboratory trials, so it sounds like they're out there, are showing that this miraculous herb could be a remedy for several diseases, mental disorders, Alzheimer's, schizophrenia, depression, insomnia, stress, indigestion, chronic pain, et cetera, et cetera. We've heard all that before. That having been said, I'm convinced this needs to be Class B felony. Dealing in this stuff, I'm satisfied. B felony, that's the amendment. And I would also recognize Dr. Wampler's concern about the ability to identify for the crime lab. The tighter we can make the language of the statute, the better it'll be for all involved down the line. So I'd propose an amendment on that to specifically identify the portion of this that the crime lab can isolate. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you. Chair Krieger and then also Representative Hicks. I agree with what Randy said. He actually agreed, I mean, mentioned this to us earlier, as well as Rob Ovett, the district attorney over in Lincoln County. We do have a dash ones right now that to specifically identify what Randy's concerns are with this. But I guess I bring this before you because right now the bill's pretty simple and it just talks about delivery. So there's two other components to the whole issue when you move forward with dealing with controlled substance. You also have the manufacturer part, and you also have the possession part. So that's, you know, of the 21 states, they have all three of those components. So I am just curious as to what the wishes are of this committee. I mean, if you're wanting to move forward with this, I could move forward with the dash twos also plugging in those other two components.
I would suggest that you do that. I think we need to have a little conversation about where we're going to rank it in severity. But when I ask the question, medical value that it might have, anything that's illegal, they're going to try to find a way to use the medical as the reason they have to have it. We're out in front of this now, and I'd like to see us really shut this down and make sure there are no holes. Representative Schaffer?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we went through a lot of pain in this building relating to medical marijuana, which I support, just not my tower crane operator being using it while I'm working under it. But I do hope we do address the medical side of this as well, not just make it a felony to possess and distribute, but also do whatever we need to do to make sure it has to be prescribed in a medical fashion, just to make sure we're locked down. Unlike, I might add, a medical marijuana card. Thank you very much.
Chair Krieger, just really quick with what Representative Schaffler said, this would be a real easy thing to find out as to what the 21 states have done for considering the medical side of it. I mean, that would be a simple report.
Okay, Representative Garrett.
Thank you. I guess I'm curious, since this has been on the legislature's radar screen before, this is the first I've ever heard of this substance at all, but what has been the resistance to criminalizing this? And, I mean, the feds usually aren't slow to move on substances. What's been their hesitation about criminalizing this so far?
Chair Krieger, Representative Garrett, I honestly can't answer that question. I don't know. As I look back at the history of what happened with the other two bills, or the three bills previously, I think one of them that scared the legislature at the time was it was such an unknown back in 2003, and that it was being classified as a Schedule 2, so it was a Class B felony. And with that came 10 years. And then in 2007, again, it was being classified as a Schedule 2, but the punishment was lower. So those are things I think that probably prevented any movement at the time. That's the only thing I can suggest at this point.
Is that Mark? I can remember the 2007 hearing. There were some people came in and said they were buying this at the smoke shops, and they were saying that it was a great asset and enhanced their sexual lives and so on. And there was some reluctance on the part of the committee to criminalize it because they felt, I believe, as I recall, that to criminalize it would make it very desirable, and that just to leave it alone. But sleeping dogs lie, I think, was the way it went out in 2007. That's where I remember that.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. This is the first time I've heard of this substance as well, and I'd be interested to find out a little bit more about the history. I mean, is this a plant that was just developed 20 years ago, or does it have a 1,000-year history, or is it used in any religious ceremonies or not? I don't want a peyote situation. Those types of questions, I think we should move and get that information, but those are the types of questions that I want us to be careful about.
And co-chairs, Representative Wand in particular, in the pendency leading up to this was considered for classification under the federal system, and that question was deferred. It remains a drug of interest, and there are plans to return to it. The significant concerns that were raised at that time have roughly echoed what you've been tracking. First of all, there are some religious practices associated with salvia. They're generally not in the United States. Salvia has of its place of origin cloud forests in Mexico. There's some shamanistic history around that. There's been some appropriation of that in the United States. Secondly, in terms of medical considerations, and this goes back to what Representative Schaffler had to say as well, there's a very good federal record. There was a lot of testimony submitted on the medical issue, and at this point there's simply a lack of consensus. Tests are going on, and as you know, to schedule something federally, you need to have some sense of whether it has any medical viability. So I know where those materials are, and I'll make sure that the committee receives them.
Thank you.
Andy, excuse me, do you have anyone else that was not signed up?
Yep. Yeah, Officer Robert Hayes from Albany Police Department. Please.
Okay. Please state your name.
Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee. My name for the record is Robert David Hayes. I'm a police officer with the City of Albany. I'm a drug recognition expert, and I've been certified as a drug recognition expert since 1997. Part of that is I've become an instructor, so I teach throughout the state, teaching other officers to become proficient in identifying people under the influence of drugs, as well as teach nationally for the International Association of Chiefs of Police. Salvia is out there. It's been hitting hard for probably the last 5 years, 7 years. We have, as a drug recognition expert, we listed under the category of hallucinogen. It elevates blood pressure, elevates pulse rate, dilates the pupils, and causes hallucinating effects. In the program, we have about 50 to 60 toxicology results that result in a hallucinating effect of impaired drivers. Salvia is very powerful. We don't see it a lot in people operating motor vehicles for the simple fact is when people use this drug, they're told to have pretty much a babysitter with them, meaning the effects are going to be so severe that they have one person who's supposedly totally sober in the same room with them, and to make sure that they don't fall down, don't injure themselves, and don't escape out into public. It's being used widely with use, it's just very powerful in the hallucinating effects.
Okay, questions? Just another one we need, isn't it? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks.
Close the public hearing on 3131. And open a public hearing on 3133.
And co-chairs, members of the committee, House Bill 3133 authorizes law enforcement agencies in accordance with the National Highway Traffic and Safety Administration regulations on the subject to establish roadblocks for the purpose of detecting and prosecuting drivers under the influence of intoxicants. The proponents of the bill note that this the passability of this bill would be contingent on House Joint Resolution 25 and its referral to the people of Oregon to amend the Constitution, which currently prohibits the use of this sort of a checkpoint.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Andy Olson, and I'm back. Anyways, I'm from Albany, and I just want to talk to you a little bit about House Bill 3133. As Aaron had mentioned, this is a kind of a companion bill, so to speak, of HJR 25, which has been heard in the last couple weeks down in Rules. What this bill does is actually it allows police to be able to use checkpoints again to combat drunken driving. That's what this does. That's how simple this is. But the thing is that this House Bill 3133 does, it brings in what policy would be for law enforcement to follow should we move forward through a referral of the HJR 25 that the voters would like to see that happen again. And let me just share with you what Article 9, Section 1 of the Constitution of the State of Oregon says, and then how simple you'll see what HJR 25 does, but then the connection with what this bill does. No law shall violate the right of people to secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable search or seizure, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the person or thing to be seized. HJR 25, narrowly written, says this. This section does not prohibit the use of sobriety checkpoints by law enforcement officials. That's it. Now, I spent 29 years with the Oregon State Police, and during that time period, prior to when, in 1987, when the Oregon Supreme Court prohibited the use of random checkpoints due to the constitutionality that I just shared with you, I had the opportunity to be involved in them and participate in checking people as they traveled through checkpoints, as well as manage them as and be part of structuring them. I found them, this was before we had the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration rules. So we did have policy in place, though, for my old agency to follow of, you described what type of process, what check it would be if you stopped every vehicle or if it was every fifth vehicle. So you had that identified through the check before you entered into it. You actually kind of gave a notification to the public through the media as well as the radio that a checkpoint would occur within this county. You just never did identify where it was at. And you would also identify through signs that you were entering into a checkpoint. So drivers would know as they approached. And you tried to, you know, just keep the people there when you did have them stop about as short as possible and let them move on. Your key objective was to determine whether or not somebody was under the influence of intoxicants. That was it. Now, that's exactly what this document right here does, the NHTSA report, or National Highway Traffic Safety. I don't want Representative Tomei to get mad at me for using acronyms. So, but, okay, thank you. All I'm wanting for you to do is to take in consideration of moving this House Bill 3133, because this would be the companion and the mechanism for us to move forward then, should HJR 25 passed by the voters. And this would actually, I mean, solidify what we're wanting to do. There's something else that you have to take in consideration, too, that there are 38 other states right now, including the District of Columbia, that permit sobriety checkpoints. And the states have experienced a 20% reduction in highway fatalities and serious injuries as a result. This would mean 30 fewer deaths per year in Oregon, 2,100 fewer serious injuries, and over 150 fewer emergency room visits per month would save Oregonians millions of dollars in health care costs. Just another thought for you to consider with this, what this would do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is, I knew this was going to be a painful committee to sit on. And it has. It's also been an incredibly fascinating and educating experience. And I'm grateful for this committee and all the members. And this is one of those painful moments when you have to look a dear friend in the eye and not agree with them. I just cannot support something that is going to pull over every single person on the highway and search them. I understand the need to cut down the deaths due to drunk driving in this state absolutely and completely, and I support efforts to do that. But if you use that same logic about it's going to reduce deaths, you could apply the same logic to saying, well, we shouldn't have any guns because we'll reduce deaths without them. And I'm a hardcore gun owner and gun rights advocate, and this is one of the few times where I will side with Andrea Meyer and ACLU and criminal defense attorneys in this committee. I just wanted to get it out there. I've shared this with my friends on this committee already, but I just had to be up front on the record and looking in the eye. And I have the greatest respect for you and the gentlemen here that have served in law enforcement, and I can't imagine some of the things you saw out there on duty. And I appreciate your service and the intention of this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Krieger, Representative Schaffler, just really quick on that. Don't jump to conclusions yet so quickly that we are given the license to search the vehicle entirely. I have, again, two drug recognition experts that will come in and testify, and they're actually going to show you a little video clip of what one of the other states are doing right now. You'll see how simple it is. You'll see how intrusive it is, or a lack of intrusiveness. But you'll see how professional and respectful it is, because that's really, I mean, that's my background. That's what I believe in, serving the public, and still to this date. And that's the only reason that I would ever move anything forward like that.
And, Mr. Chair, if I may, I think I will follow through with my reputation for having an incredibly open mind, Representative.
Well, then, I would actually like to, I have a number of other folks that would like to testify, but if we could have the two officers, that would be great.
You want to have them up here now?
Yep.
Okay.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee. My name is Michael Ely. I'm a patrol sergeant with the Oregon State Police, and I'm assigned out of general headquarters. I'm also the Drug Evaluation Classification Program State Coordinator, which basically means I have 170 active drug recognition experts, and I also have 8 regional coordinators. I'm here today to talk about House Bill 3133, and I want the, both chairs to understand and also the committee that the Oregon State Police maintains a neutral position in House Bill 3133. I did testify earlier on House Joint Resolution 25 to House Rules, and this is basically the same testimony, written testimony, that I've provided the committee here today on. I've done a lot of research on how other states are currently conducting sobriety checkpoints. And so without, I'll just continue on. The Highway Traffic Safety Administration and other organizations consistently have found that their efforts for reducing motor vehicle crashes is in large part due to high visibility enforcement. And high visibility enforcement is a mechanism through NHTSA where they utilize different methods to target impaired driving. Such as patrol saturations. Other states also incorporate sobriety checkpoints, the use of DUI courts, the use of drug recognition experts. They're all tied into high visibility enforcement. Currently in Oregon, how does it affect us currently? Well, right now we do a lot of high visibility enforcement. So we'll have agencies partnership together or alone. They will go out and they will work DUI overtime. Well, they will target impaired drivers. Of course, with that, there are some pros and cons with high visibility enforcement regarding patrol saturations. And Officer Robert Hayes will talk more specifically about that with respect to smaller agencies. In Oregon, we have determined the high visibility enforcement periods where you have a joint unified enforcement effort from city, county, and state are basically on my written testimony that I provided for you. It's the Christmas holiday, which includes New Year's, Super Bowl Sunday, Memorial period, Independence Day, Labor Day holiday, and also Thanksgiving. And as you know, Lieutenant Greg Hastings from the Oregon State Police does a tremendous job with giving us a brief history on what's to come, meaning there's going to be a saturation around Christmas, and these are going to be the periods. Once the period ends, Lieutenant Greg Hastings then compiles the statistics and then puts that out to the media as well. These are the results of us actually having a saturation patrol. Sobriety checkpoints for many states have been a tool, as the representative said earlier, since 1980. Currently, there are 38 states plus the District of Columbia that partake in sobriety checkpoints. Here's the thing with sobriety checkpoints, though, because the goal is we want to deter drivers who may consider driving impaired through fear of arrest. And through fear of arrest, they choose not to drive. And they'll find other ways of safe transportation. Sobriety checkpoints can be conducted in two parts. They can be conducted in low staffing checkpoints or full staffing checkpoints. And when I say full staffing and low staffing, I'm talking about the number of personnel it's going to take in order for them to effectively conduct the sobriety checkpoint. Typical considerations for sobriety checkpoints, through my research, I have found that they all include policies and guidelines, site selection, warning devices, that includes mass signage and lighting, visible police authority, chemical testing logistics, contingency plans. When I say contingency plans, I'm talking about if you had picked an area to do a sobriety checkpoint and you did not anticipate how busy that checkpoint would be, then there's a contingency plan that is done ahead of time. So as a representative alluded to earlier, if we decide to stop every third vehicle and because it is causing a traffic congestion for that particular level of roadway, they move it to every 10th vehicle. And this is done prior to. It's not done at the time of the sobriety checkpoint through my research on this. Additionally, it talks about contingency plans, detection and investigation techniques, operational briefings, public information and education, data collection and evaluation. That includes also a questionnaire given to the public, people traveling through. And also you want to evaluate your efficiency in your operation when you have concluded with the sobriety checkpoint operations. Last year in Pima County, Arizona, 17 sobriety checkpoints were conducted, and they reported the following statistics. 269 DUI arrests, with over 13,000 contacted through checkpoints, and this was reported by the state coordinator in Arizona. Arizona also reported mail-in surveys for 2010. So I'm just going to read to you some of the questions that they give the motorists as they come through. Did the sobriety checkpoint cause a significant delay in your journey? yes, 7%, no, 93%. Do you believe sobriety checkpoints will deter some people from driving while impaired? Yes, 86%, no, 14%. Do you believe sobriety checkpoints will increase an impaired driver's risk of being detected and arrested? Yes, 94%, no, 6%. Do you approve of sobriety checkpoints as an enforcement measure to detect and remove impaired drivers from the roadways in your community? Yes, 93%, no, 7%. Do you live in the area of the checkpoints? Yes, 57%, no, 43%. Have you ever been arrested for DUI? Yes, 5%, no, 95%. It also asks what your age is, and were you a designated driver? Yes, 21%, no, 79%. In Pennsylvania, checkpoints may be conducted with the district attorney's office being the lead agency. In Maryland, sobriety checkpoints are conducted in a manner where the motorist is not asked for their driver's license or registration as they're coming through, and it takes approximately 20 to 30 seconds for the unimpaired driver to get through the checkpoint. In California, well, California does it different among the other states I've just talked about. They also include a sobriety checkpoint with a license checkpoint. Through my research of the states that conduct sobriety checkpoints, I have found several commonalities between the states that have them, best practice policies and guidelines with training, limit the amount of vehicular congestion and inconvenience, safety measures for motorists, law enforcement, and limited arrest numbers. That is my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Show the video.
You go first.
Thank you. Co-Chair Krieger, Co-Chair Barker. Members of the committee. For the record, my name is Robert Hayes. I'm a police officer with the City of Albany. I've been a police officer for 19 years. I'm currently assigned to patrol. I'm a crash reconstructionist, and I'm on the MATE team, which is a multi-agency investigation team. I'm called out to probably 90% of all traffic fatalities in Lynn-Benton County. And unfortunately, a number of those crashes involve impaired drivers. I'm also chair of the DUII Multidisciplinary Training Task Force and chair for the Lynn County DUII Victim Impact Panel. I'm here today to testify in support of 3133 in regards from the Albany Police Department as well as from the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. I'm not going to reiterate what Sergeant Ewy just stated in regards to the facts of the checkpoints, but I want to talk to you about the saturation patrols. Currently, agencies are given dollars to go out and enforce like click it or ticket or DUII saturations. Unfortunately, agencies such as mine and other smaller agencies don't have the manpower to do a full saturation patrol. What we're doing is we're sending one officer out there to go do a DUII enforcement for 6 hours. And the reason I bring that up is a basic police officer that's conducting a DUI investigation, once he stops that vehicle and determines he has an impaired driver, that investigation is probably going to take an hour to an hour and a half. And that's not including an hour to an hour and a half of written reports. So that officer pretty much in that 6 hour period is off the road for probably 3 to 5 hours of his actual patrol looking for impaired drivers. We also, saturation patrols, we do saturation patrols with a multi-agency traffic team. And what that is actually a saturation patrol. For example, we go up on the Santiam Pass and we look for obviously impaired drivers as well as speeding motorists and seatbelt violations. That's done with our agency, Lynn County Sheriff's Office, Sweet Home Police Department, Lebanon Police Department, and Oregon State Police. That runs about 10 to 12 cars. That is saturation. You have a number of cars out there doing that enforcement. That's not the way the DUI enforcement is being done with the smaller agencies. It's one officer out there. Departments are having budget issues, so this reducing the number of traffic teams, and with agencies reducing the number of patrol officers, this takes time for self-initiated activity to go down. It focuses on taking calls for service and not having time to detect and arrest the impaired driver. People believe there's a greater chance for being stopped at a checkpoint than during a saturation patrol. Plus, with the limited police resources we have today, it is a challenge to conduct an effective high visibility saturation in some areas of the state, while smaller, high visible, well publicized checkpoint will normally be more effective overall. Recently in Florida, they conducted a checkpoint, a sobriety checkpoint. And in that checkpoint, they had two cases where the person was stopped and evaluated. At the conclusion of that evaluation, they determined the person was not impaired but had a medical issue. Those two people were taken to the hospital where they were admitted, not to jail. So these checkpoints are also going to help find people that might have medical issues out there operating motor vehicles. And with that, I'll answer any questions in the video.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Representative. So, sir, How would you do that in Albany? How would you have a checkpoint if you've only got one officer on duty?
What we would do if we had a checkpoint is I would contact probably the Lebanon Police Department, Linn County Sheriff's Office, Oregon State Police, and do a combined agency enforcement effort where you can use resources from other agencies. A small checkpoint, a small scale one, is usually 3 to 5 police officers. And a large-scale checkpoint is going to be between 10 and 12 police officers. So that's how we would do that.
Representative Pierre.
So if you were to do a multi-agency checkpoint like that, why couldn't you take the same effort and do a multi-agency saturation patrol? I guess what I'm having a hard, what I have a hard time with on this is, it's a checkpoint strikes me as basically over-inclusive. You're going to get a few people who might be intoxicated, but you're also spending a lot of law enforcement time and energy on people who aren't doing anything wrong. And that strikes me as inefficient when we want to have law enforcement out on the roads actually looking for people who are breaking the law. So help me understand why it's a better use of your resources to have a multi-agency checkpoint rather than a multi-agency saturation patrol.
My answer to that would be, Representative Garrett, Co-Chair Krieger, it's another tool to use, all right? And part of these sobriety checkpoints, we just don't set up these signs and show up unannounced in the community and just do a checkpoint. There's a large media blitz that takes place. For example, in Linn County, we'll be having a sobriety checkpoint on this date, and the location will actually be given out to the media beforehand so people know that it's coming. It's another way to deter the person, knowing that there is a possibility of having a checkpoint out there. It's another tool to use through the media as well to help people make a better decision instead of driving impaired to take other means of transportation.
Follow up.
Do you think it would be as effective to have a media blitz saying we're going to have a saturation patrol on this date? Because if anything, a checkpoint seems like something that a driver can avoid. If you know it's down the road, you can get off the road before you hit it. If you know there's just a saturation patrol out there, you really can't plan to avoid it. So I wonder if we would have the same deterrent effect. Can you comment on that?
Did you want to answer that?
Okay. Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee, usually in the sobriety checkpoints, what other states are doing, the commonalities that I found out was that they also incorporate saturation patrols for that very reason, is that, for example, in Arizona and in Maryland, what they will do is they will give you the date of the sobriety checkpoint and the county of the sobriety checkpoint, and then anywhere between 4 and 2 hours, they will release it exactly where it's going to be, meaning the cross intersection of the road of travel, it will be given at that point. Sobriety checkpoints, from my research, I've also found out they don't really last any longer than 4 to 6 hours because by then everyone knows there's a sobriety checkpoint at any given location. But you're right, the numbers are not going to be very high with the arrests because its goal of a sobriety checkpoint is to deter people from driving while impaired.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We need to address the discussion from all angles. I do though want to point out that I have a little bit of a concern about frankly loss of evidence, which isn't the best way of putting it, but what I'm saying is this: is if an officer follows an impaired driver long enough, the chances are, I think, pretty good they're going to witness some kind of moving violation eventually. And juries, the feedback seems to indicate, like to see bad driving. Like juries like to see, in fact, you'd be recording that. Well, OSP might not, but a lot of agencies are able to record that, and that is good evidence. It drives the point home in a way that, you know, if I were prosecuting one of these cases, my opening would be, you know, Trooper Olson was manning a sobriety checkpoint, pulling over every third car. Frankly, people don't want to hear that. And so there is a little bit of a challenge that I think the prosecution is going to have to contend with that, and we aren't going to have that evidence of bad driving. And I wonder if in your experience you could comment on that.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to speak on behalf of that because neither one of these officers have ever been around from when we used to have checkpoints. If you're paying attention to the traffic that's traveling through, and because it's controlled in the first place for the lanes that are designed for them to come into a stop, generally, you can tell when somebody's you know, being affected to a perceptible degree, I mean, before they even stop. So if you're talking about concern for evidence, all you have to do is pay attention at the very beginning when they first come in. It's amazing how many times people would run over a cone. It's amazing how many times people down at the sign that would say checkpoint ahead would make a sweeping turn and run off into the ditch on the other side of the road. I mean, maybe, you know, just that's some of the things you have to pay attention to.
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, Representative Olson is actually correct that I have not done a sobriety checkpoint with the Oregon State Police. However, before I became a state trooper in 1997, I was in the United States Army for 5 years active duty as a military policeman. And we had checkpoints everywhere, meaning that we checked everyone's identification as they were coming through. And Representative Olson's also correct in the fact that we don't necessarily, although we would like to have additional driving, that's part of the vehicle in motion phase for DUI detection. Part of that is also when they come to a stop. What is the officer observing when they come to a stop? Then there's also the second phase, which is personal contact. And a sobriety checkpoint, you're obviously going to have a personal contact within that 20 to 30 seconds on is this individual impaired or not. So we do capture some of it, but you're right. We're not going to have that 30 seconds of video where the person's having a hard time maintaining lane, and that's going to be captured on video. You're correct.
Okay, committee, we're getting short on time. We do have some more people who want to testify. Do you have a video?
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee, yes, I do.
You know how long it is?
3 minutes, sir.
Please play it.
State police started doing sobriety checkpoints that were done back in 1982, 83, and we've done varying numbers of them throughout the years around the state. The process is really the same. I mean, we're controlled by court law, court cases to say what we have to do. We set up checkpoints at locations that have been identified as having a problem with impaired driving. Now, if the person comes upon a sobriety checkpoint, there's signs placed up before notifying them they're coming into a checkpoint. There's all kinds of police vehicles with their lights flashing. The law enforcement officers will be lined up there. They'll stop them where they want them to stop, and they'll only be stopped there for maybe 20, 30 seconds at the most. They don't have to produce driver's license, registration. That's not what we're there checking for. The law enforcement officer will communicate with them there for that short amount of time. Determine whether they detect any odor, an alcoholic beverage, any indicators of impairment. And if none of that is detected, then the person is directed on through and they can go on down the road. If the law enforcement officer detects an odor, an alcoholic beverage, or indicators of impairment, then they would direct the person over to the side of the road, an area that's designated as a stopping area. And when the law enforcement officer tests somebody for impairment, they're really looking for psychophysical impairment. And most of the time we use the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration approved standardized field sobriety tests. That consists of checking a person's eyes for horizontal gaze nystagmus, and we also do the walk and turn and one leg stand test. They're standardized tests. There's some other tests that law enforcement officers may choose to do, a finger count test. They may have them recite the alphabet, not backwards, forward. Then they have them do some counting exercises and so forth. You know, we're trying to get the public to know that traffic safety is public safety. Too many times we hear, you know, why aren't you out dealing with the real crime? Why are you dealing with these? Well, in the state of Maryland, we lose as many people every year, more people actually, every year from traffic fatalities as we do from homicides. The sobriety checkpoints are just one part of a campaign of high visibility DUI enforcement initiative that we're doing. We also do saturation patrols, which is putting a large number of law enforcement officers in a problem area and having them out looking for DUI enforcement. We try to publicize those. We put markings on the car to show that they're out there doing DUI enforcement. We may put some signs in the area indicating this is a DUI enforcement zone. People look at law enforcement officers as arresting the bad guys, arresting the impaired driver, and certainly we do that. But there's a lot more we can do in trying to prevent impaired driving. And the ideal thing is to prevent a person from doing it to start with. And so as long as the public knows that we're out there, we're concentrating on this, we're really looking for the impaired drivers,
then hopefully it'll cause them to take an extra time to think about having that last drink before they leave wherever they are, before they go out and get on the road. Be a little more careful about how much they're drinking.
Thank you, Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I have Doug Hackerode come up and Ann Pratt. We have about 40 minutes for the remainder of this bill with three more people that want to testify and also two bills to go to work session. So try to use your time wisely.
Chair Krieger and Co-Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name's Ann Pratt. I'm here on behalf of Mothers Against Drunk Driving. I've submitted written testimony for them. I'm also the Vice President of Crime Victims United, and Crime Victims United also wholeheartedly supports House Bill 3133. I also submitted testimony on behalf of Governor's is Chuck Hayes, our chair, has testimony on behalf of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII. I am going to skip over parts of my testimony, not to repeat what's already been said. Checkpoints are, basically, I want to relate how checkpoints would affect Oregon. Checkpoints are a very simple law enforcement tool, and the primary goal of sobriety checkpoints is not to arrest people, but rather deter people. And checkpoints have the greatest deterrent value of all impaired driving enforcement. The perceived risk of getting caught keeps many drunk and drugged drivers off our roads. Checkpoints, like has been said, takes only about 30 seconds, about the same time as a traffic light. It's nothing like security at an airport these days. Both are for our safety, but 30 seconds is not a very long period of time. Checkpoints are constitutional. There was a case in Michigan versus Sites that ruled that checkpoints were constitutional. I don't have the year on that, but perhaps somebody else does. Okay, so what would checkpoints mean for Oregon? In 2009, according to ODOT, 116 people were killed by alcohol, 28 by alcohol and drugs combination, 37 drugs alone. That's 181 people. This is just in 2009. 181 people died a very preventable and senseless death on Oregon roadways. The Center for Disease Control found that sobriety checkpoints can reduce related crashes and fatalities by 18 to 24%. So if we apply a medium 20% reduction in crashes and DUI fatalities, according to the CDC, we could have saved 36 lives alone in Oregon in 2009. We've had more than two decades of research that demonstrate that sobriety checkpoints work. If we had had sobriety checkpoints in Oregon for the last 24 years, we could have saved 724 people. If one of your family members was one of those 724 people, you also would not be able to comprehend why there would be any excuse why Oregon doesn't have this life-saving tool. We can't change the past, but we can change the future, and that's why we're all here. And we're all in this together. Everyone in this state, everyone in this room, no matter what walk of life or occupation, 3 out of 10 of us will become a victim of a drunk driver sometime in our life. Other facts are, checkpoints are cost effective because of the high cost of crashes in society. According to Mothers Against Drunk Driving, just one fatality is $1.2 million. That's the monetary cost. If you take those 181 fatalities in 2009 and multiply it by $1.2 million, you get over $219 million for cost just for 2009. Sobriety checkpoints, as it was said, do take fewer officers and saturation patrols. And studies have consistently found that societal savings from checkpoints significantly outweigh investment initial investment, up to $23 for each dollar invested. Recently, Pennsylvania bumped up its use of sobriety checkpoints and reduced their drink driving fatalities from 499 fatalities in 2008 to 406 in 2009. The public favors sobriety checkpoints. Generally, 75% want checkpoints with a 90% approval after implementation. There are 12 states who do not have checkpoints. Oregon is one of them. Let's remove Oregon from that deadly list. Every man, woman, and child has the right to drive or ride on Oregon highways without the threat of being seriously injured or killed by an intoxicated driver. Sobriety checkpoints are good public safety. Let's let Oregonians decide whether they want to have checkpoints. We urge you to forward this life-saving bill. Thank you.
Chairs Krieger and Barker, members of the committee, my name is Doug Harkelrode. I'm the retired Lane County District Attorney, and I represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance. The Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance is strongly in support of House Bill 3133 for all of the reasons Ms. Pratt has said. I submitted a brief written testimony, it's in addition to saturation patrols, it's in addition to solid sentencing for repeat intoxicated drivers. It's one more way to save lives. Just tell you briefly, I am the victim of a drunk driver, and I'm one of the lucky ones. 1987, Sunday afternoon, 4:30, my young son then and I were driving on a four-lane highway. I was rear-ended by a drunk driver at least 70 miles an hour, sent 450 feet approximately across two lanes of traffic. Thank God nobody was in those lanes coming at me, and barely got the vehicle stopped short of a great big oak tree. I had injuries to my neck that were very painful for over a year. My son had a concussion. We were very lucky, because I'm sitting here talking to you today about this. We need this tool. It's one more tool, and if it would save one life next year because we had this tool, it would be well worth having this tool. The last thing I would say is I was here the other day testifying and recommending you not amend the Constitution, and we should do that very carefully. This is a good, careful approach to save lives. Thank you.
Committee, do you have any questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We have Fred Yates, Andrea Meyer, and Gail Meyer come up, please.
Okay. Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. Andrea Meyer, legislative director of the ACLU of Oregon, here today in opposition to House Bill 3133. To speak to this bill really requires me to cover the context of HDR 25, which, as Representative Olson has explained, is a constitutional referral to the voters to amend Article 1, Section 9. And since he read the text, I will not do that. But it is a really serious issue to bring the Bill of Rights and provide an amendment to it that actually weakens the effect. And the Oregon Bill of Rights, which took effect in 1859, was premised on the belief that it was necessary to protect the people against government infringement of our fundamental rights. And the principle of our equivalent of the Fourth Amendment, Article 1, Section 9, as the Oregon Supreme Court stated, is before government officials can embark on a search or seizure for evidence to be used for the defendant's criminal prosecution, they must have individualized suspicion of wrongdoing. And that compact between Oregonians and the government sets forth fundamental principles that have guided us successfully in 152 years. There have been in recent years, and I think I'll be testifying in a few weeks about this, a number of constitutional referrals to the voters to amend our Bill of Rights provisions for often very eloquent, persuasive reasons to deal with what are purported to be safety issues or to provide safeguards to all of us. And yet each of those times, voters have rejected that. I am proud to sit here today and say that the ACLU of Oregon was behind the lawsuit that challenged this roadblock provision that was going on in 1986, and were successful in doing that. And I think it's informative, though, to explain the context from the perspective of our plaintiff, Ms. Nelson, and briefly cover her experience, because it really illustrates why we oppose this. Actually, it went back as far as December 1982. She had been working as administrative aide to the Eugene City Manager's Office, and that evening she attended the mayor's Christmas party. She had one glass of wine at 6:30, followed by hors d'oeuvres, and then dinner, dessert, and coffee. And she headed home for around 10:15. She was driving east on Interstate 105 when she encountered a vehicle weaving and driving erratically. It passed her friend. She suspected it was a drunk driver, and when she finally exited the freeway and saw that car continue on, she was quite relieved. She then encounters flashing lights and about 6 or 10 patrol vehicles from the Oregon State Police and Lane County Sheriff's Office. There was a long line of cars. It took her about 15 minutes to reach it, but when she did, she asked the officer, was there an escape or something going on? No. She was told there was a sobriety checkpoint that they were engaged in. She was asked when she had her last drink. She told them exactly what I've already told you. Her friend, who was in the car, leaned over to the trooper and said, she's not the one who's been drinking as a problem. There was a guy we just encountered who's the drunk driver. You should go after. Well, for a variety of reasons, as a result of that, Ms. Nelson was pulled over for further testing, and after successfully passing all those tests, was finally released. There was no evidence that she was intoxicated in any way. She called us. We didn't contact her. She called us because she felt strongly that the roadblock had been a waste of police resources and actually made the public safe. She felt, and we agree, and others have testified or asked questions about this, that the police should focus on drivers who are exhibiting visible signs of driving under the influence rather than stopping hundreds of innocent people. Over the years, thankfully, since Nelson, this state, this legislature has taken even more increasing steps to deter individuals from getting behind the wheel who are intoxicated. But at the same time, when we are looking at this and looking to amend our Constitution, we think it's important to examine the fact, and you've heard some questions and comments today, about the tools already available that do not require amending our Bill of Rights. And those namely have been saturation patrols as well as other tools. And saturation patrols have been shown to be more effective to stopping actual drunk drivers at a lesser cost than roadblocks. Data shows that police roadblocks result in far fewer arrests per officer than either routine traffic patrols and saturation patrols. And I think the reason you've heard is the testimony that this actually is a deterrent for people to get on the road. They're afraid of it. The major part of that deterrent, as you've heard, is the publication of and wide knowledge about the existence of these roadblocks. That same success can be done with saturation patrols. And unlike roadblocks, which existed 20 years ago, saturation patrols, as you've heard, can be in a variety of locations. Roadblocks, when Representative Olson was probably dealing with them, people probably didn't tweet or text the location and information to people to help avoid it. That is an added tool now available. But more importantly, here's one of the important differences between saturation patrols and roadblocks. Saturation patrols can be done anywhere, including highways. Roadblocks require a good number of officers to set up all the systems to ensure the safety of the officers in the roadway as they pull people over. But not only can saturation patrols be anywhere and should be everywhere, they also allow officers to go after reckless activity, distracted driving, and all the things that make our roads less safe and that I certainly encounter on my drive daily from I-5, whether it's texting or phones. Briefly, I want to touch upon House Bill 3133 because it authorizes a law enforcement agency to establish police roadblocks if it uses the guidelines set forth in the National Traffic Safety Administration publication. But those guidelines, which I have reviewed, do not require anything. Instead, as the first paragraph states, These guidelines suggest and describe operational procedures that police administrators may want to consider in order to ensure that sobriety checkpoints are used legally, effectively, and safely. It then lists a variety of components to be considered. It even urges law enforcement agencies to first have specifically established procedures in place. Rather than establishing a clearly articulated rules of operation for statewide uniformity and compliance with Oregon laws, the guidelines merely identify issues and possible recommendations for agencies, and as a result would simply result in a patchwork across the state of how roadblocks are actually administered. And in fact, those guidelines do not in any way limit the scope of the checks that can be done. You've heard different states do different things, including checking for license, insurance, car seats, seatbelt use, and other things. Those guidelines don't discuss or prohibit that. So for those two reasons, we urge you not to proceed with House Bill 3133. It's linked to the constitutional amendment, and it does not provide the necessary safeguards we think would be necessary. Thank you.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We also oppose House Bill 3133, and thank you for your attention to my comments. I just want to perhaps clarify for some on the committee that might not quite understand. There's been a reference that these have been held to be constitutional. They were held to be constitutional by the United States Supreme Court under the federal Constitution, but our Oregon Supreme Court has interpreted our Oregon search and seizure clause independently of the United States Constitution, and it provides greater protections. And our Oregon Supreme Court has said that this is pure and simple a seizure of a person, of the effects, of the vehicle, without any individualized suspicion or wrongdoing. And under the Oregon Constitution, that is per se unconstitutional and unreasonable. It's for that reason that this bill is dependent upon a referral that would amend Article 1, Section 9. I do note that Article 1, Section 9 has been with us since statehood in an unamended manner. It has not been amended in all that time frame. There are six other states that have held that the roadblocks violate their state constitutions. Well, we're one of the six. Curiously enough, one of them is Michigan. It was the Michigan case that went up to the United States Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, okay, well, it's legal under the federal constitution. They sent it back to Michigan, and they said, well, we meant what we said. This is an invasive tactic, and so they ruled that it was unconstitutional under the Michigan constitution. OCDLA would like to point out to the committee, it's in my written comments, so I won't repeat them. There are a host of current tools that law enforcement has to stop, detain, and investigate anyone whom they do think is impaired. And what's different about roadblocks is what we haven't heard is the ratio of how many drivers go through before they apprehend an impaired driver. I haven't read a ratio. I haven't heard anyone talk about a ratio. Do 20 cars go through before they find an impaired driver? Do 75 cars go through? Do 100 cars go through before they find an impaired driver? It's just... talking about Representative Garrett's comment on a lack of efficiencies, there certainly isn't a target here on any evidence of impairment. I would say that as to House Bill 3133, it incorporates this document published by the Traffic Safety Programs. There really isn't anything in here that's prescriptive, and so what its comments are guidelines, they're aspirational, but it presupposes that the agency will develop its own rules. So what you would have here is a patch quilt of procedures employed by different agencies around the state. There would be no statewide consistency, there would be no statewide oversight, there would be no state-side review. What I'm curious about is the degree to which these stops then can be used for other things as well. If an officer uses their flashlight to look in the back seat to see are there any open wine bottles, anything like that, but they see the butt of a firearm or they see fireworks in the back of the seat, do they pull the car over then to investigate those other issues? Could dogs be used to circle the perimeter of a car to detect for odor of narcotics? Could they enforce registration issues with respect to a car and perhaps pose more questions about whether or not they're driving a vehicle they have authority to drive? Would they check immigration status? These are stops. These are seizures of the person. And there's nothing in this document that would really state the degree to which additional encounters and investigations couldn't unfold from them. So again, thank you for the comments. I do think that if you're looking at evidence-based data, my read on the studies out there, it's a toss-up. But what you do have in terms of whether saturation patrols or roadblocks do one thing better than the other, I do note that if you're talking about deterrence, this National Traffic Safety publication that's incorporated into 3133 clearly says itself the use of checkpoints alone will not be an effective general deterrence. It has to be part of a more systematic and aggressive enforcement program. So roadblocks by themselves are not the panacea. So thank you for your comments, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Chair Krieger and Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Fred Yates. I'm from Linn County. I'm in opposition to this bill, but not to the need of removing drunken drivers. I understand we have drunken drivers on roads, but to violate the federal and state constitutional rights is not the proper approach to remove them. Deterrence starts before the fact, not after, and this is an after the fact. This is a locking the barn door after the horse's escape type thing. The media blitz is counterproductive. If you want to catch people, catch them. Don't warn them you're going to be there. Arizona puts up traffic cams to catch speeders, but in the newspaper every morning they tell you where they're going to be. Okay, this is not the right way to go about it. I contend a more reasonable approach would be to alter the punishment for the DUI so it'd be so onerous that they will modify their own destructive behavior. And I don't ask for prison or jail terms, which would only burden the taxpayers. Rather, they be sentenced to a lengthy public service time, which would deprive them of their free time and serve some public good at the same time, and their driving privileges be restricted to coincide with their work hours only, and a large fine be imposed. And I have 3 pages of written testimony, and I ask that you please read it. Thank you.
Thank you. Committee members?
Mr. Chair, one comment, please. Yeah, my opposition is to the stopping and searching of innocent people. If this does become a tool for law enforcement and they have narcotic sniffing dogs on the scene and they're doing a drunk driving checkpoint and that dog discovers narcotics in that car or truck, I have no problem with them locking them up in jail if through the use of this tool. My opposition is the inconveniencing and the potential search of innocent people who are not driving drunk, don't have dope, don't have guns, all that stuff. If it does become the law, I have no problem with our brothers and sisters out there protecting our community using drug-sniffing dogs to catch dope pushers and on the highways. I want to make that very clear. Thank you very much.
Schaffer, anything further? Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll close the work session, the public hearing on House Bill 3133. Representative Barker is going to do the 2 work sessions. Committee, this coming week we're going to be starting a lot of work sessions. We appreciate if you could be here on time so we don't have to reopen for you to be able to vote. Open work session, House Bill 2652. Mr. Knott.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. House Bill 2652 disqualifies an individual from serving as a fiduciary, healthcare representative, attorney, in fact, or surrogate if a prior court order terminated the parental rights of that individual. There is an amendment that has been submitted. This was in response to discussion at the time of the public hearing, which would allow a protected person's parent or former guardian to be reinstituted as a fiduciary upon the motion of the protected person. Exactly quoted, new sub 2 would say a protected person, while not incapacitated, may petition the court to remove a prohibition contained in subsection 1C, which is the one that designates that they are a
parental relationship, parent or former guardian. As amended, this bill is projected to have no revenue impact and no fiscal impact, and the amendment has not yet been introduced.
Representative Barker, do you want that amendment?
Yes.
You do?
Yeah. That allows the person in discussion. Before it said if parental rights were canceled, then they couldn't become later on. Well, at some time later on, that may be repaired, and that would allow the court to take another look at that.
Okay, I'll move the dash one amendments into House Bill 2652.
Representative Krieger moves the dash ones into House Bill 2652. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I could you just talk a little bit more about the amendment?
The amendment would allow the bill prohibited if I'm disabled and my parents lose their parental rights, mm-hmm. and then I come of age before they could come back and say I want to take over again, be as fiduciary, and there's problems with that because they lost the rights originally.
Right.
This would allow later on, should they correct their ways, and if the person petitions the court, to ask that they could be allowed to come back in. So it would be the patient would be competent to ask for the court to do that.
Could does ask that make sense? Well, it sort of does make sense, but I guess my machine isn't working, so I can't look at the original bill. But this was your original bill, correct?
Yeah, I brought that for Representative Gelser.
Okay, so I guess part of the problem was it was with disabled people.
Right.
And so even when they're adults, they may still not have...
if they don't, this would be if they did have it, if the parents had correct themselves, then the court could review that.
The court would make the decision. Thank you. That makes me feel better. Thank you.
Okay, any further decision? Is there any objection to the amendment? Ordered introduced.
Co-chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2652 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 2652 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion?
Yeah, one more, okay. If I may. So I'm assuming Representative Gelser agreed to the amendment?
Yeah, oh yes.
Terrific. Thank you.
Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan?
Yes.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shopler?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Yes.
Representative Wan?
Aye.
Representative Kuznick?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett?
Aye.
Co-Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker?
Aye.
Motion carries, and we'll have Representative Gelser be the bill carrier on the floor. Open the work session on House Bill 3153.
And thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. House Bill 3153 will add add reserve officers within the definition of peace officer and police officer for certain purposes. More specifically, this would apply for the range really throughout the criminal code, all crimes which require a peace or police officer as a predicate, furnishing false information, interfering with a peace or police officer, etc., would now include reserve officers. There is a dash one amendment, and on my staff measure summary, this states two effects. Number one, it deletes Section 4. Section 4 initially had the effect of including reserve officers within the definition of aggravated murder as a factor of class of victim that would elevate a murder to an aggravated murder. That had been deleted. There was another change that was requested and reflected in the staff measure summary, which was returned by legislative counsel. There was a request to explicitly include both a certified reserve officer and a reserve officer, both within the statutory language. However, they reside in the same overall definition, and legislative counsel concluded that both of those definitions would be incorporated in any interpretation of the initial bill. But to just so you have all information, I'd like to define reserve officer, because the definition on here was for certified. A reserve officer means an officer or a member of a law enforcement unit who is a volunteer or who is unable unemployed less than, or who is employed, I'm sorry, less than full-time as a peace officer commissioned by a city, port, school district, mass transit district, county, county service district, authorized to provide law enforcement services under ORS 451010, an Indian reservation, the Criminal Justice Division of the Department of Justice, the Oregon State Lottery Commission, or the governor, who is a member of the Department of State Police, who is armed with a firearm, and who is responsible for enforcing the criminal laws and traffic laws of the state or laws or ordinances relating to airport security. So it's a very broad category. Certified reserve officers, which we heard a bit about at the public hearing, would be a subsection of this.
Discussion. Representative Tomei.
I just want to make sure that I understand that the dash one amendment would eliminate section four so that there would not be the issue of aggravated murder.
That's correct.
Is that correct?
That
Thank
is
you.
Correct. Oh, and I apologize. Co-chairs, Representative Tomei, I should also note that this is projected to have no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact, not sufficient to warrant a statement.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, I'd like to move the dash one amendments into House Bill 3153.
Representative Krieger moves the dash one amendments into House Bill 3153. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, so ordered.
Chair Barker, I'd like to move House Bill 3153 as amended to the floor with the due pass.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 3153 as amended to the floor with the due pass. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shoffler.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Wan.
Aye.
Representative Quisnett.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett.
Aye.
Co-Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker.
Aye.
Motion carries. I'll carry the bill. Coming down secure. Any further business? Come before the committee. Adjourned.